Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me like this is on?
Yes.
Yep.
Great. For those of you, was there anybody here for the first time? Oh, great. My name is Tamika Tyler. My pronouns are she, her, and this is the class on Theopoetics. Today, we are going to look at some case studies in Theopoetics, but for those of you who are first timers, no need to be anxious. I will review the first 2 days. And like I said before the recording, you also have access to this PowerPoint, which has the entire week worth of information on it. Also, just as a reminder for those who are new, we are going to do the presentations here. Then we're going to take a field trip to get ice cream, as promised, on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, one of those days that ends with a Y. And we're going to walk over and have some ice cream and finish out conversation there. So, day three, case studies in Theopoetics. And as we should, we're going to start with poetry. These two poems are liturgical poems that were written for one of the projects, the Subversive Liturgy Project, which we're going to learn about today. So this first poem is entitled, What We've Lost. When the last bit of elixir is gone from cup, we hold our breath, savor the sweetness on our tongues. When the taste has left us, we close our eyes and turn to the palates of our imagination. For some, it is customary to savor as long and as often as we can, hoping that our memory will appease the void that the event once filled. For others, nothing can satisfy the longing of what was. Reconciliation escapes us. Regret becomes our comfort. We who have lost must not forget what we have gained. And we who have gained must always embrace the sacrifice of loss. The second poem is read as a call to worship. And it's thus entitled, A Call to Worship. You'll notice I don't really have great titles. This is a call to worship. Out of the boldness of our fear, we scream into the darkness. Cries of help that are swallowed by silence, we are only left to grope. Unsure of what is around or beneath us, we only know to keep moving forward. If we are able to strain our ears just enough, we can hear the echoes of our cries return to us, unaccompanied and hollow. Yet we press on into that space where we are the most unsure, the most unsafe, and in doing so, we find our hope, patiently waiting our return. As a review, first day you learned about the historical concepts of Theopoetics, mostly influenced by three major events. The nonprofit Society of Arts, Religion, and Contemporary Culture, led by the artist who was the first director of Modern Museum of Art in New York, and Paul Tillich and others. Consultations and Hermeneutics, which is the study of interpretation, and the notion about talking about God through experience, and the Death of God movement. We learned that Theopoetic scholars came from various fields, yet they all agreed on the role of the imagination and the arts as central to understanding God, and that each of these areas represent a need to understand God in a new way, a move from rigid logical systems to one where imagination and the arts are centered. That was day one. Day two, we learned that Theopoetics is an emphasis, style, and positive concern for the intersection of religious reflection and spirituality with the imagination, aesthetics, and the arts, especially as it takes shape in ways that grows community, focuses on material change, and affirms the importance of embodiment. We also learned you have to take a deep breath before you say things about Theopoetics. We learned about the different ebbs and flows of how that definition intersects with different notions of community, particularly the Mexican community, the Black community, notions of feminism, notions of epistemologies as central, poetic epistemologies as central. And we also learned a four-point methodology, engaging and understanding our social location as well as the social location of the thing that we are researching. Radical inquiry, investigation into the voices that have been centered and have not been centered, asking the God question, not just what does God say about the thing that we are investigating, but what does that thing say about our understanding of the divine and the human condition. And finally, what does it mean that there is an artistic embodied response to the work that we are doing? That was day two. So today, we're going to look at some case studies in Theopoetics. We're going to look at the Theopoetic Conference, which is kind of like a communal, academic kind of gathering that is done in a way that kind of feels like an anti-conference. We're going to look at the Subversive Liturgy Project, which uses liturgy and liturgical services as protest. We're going to look at the George Floyd Memorial and the work that is being done there and relates to the arts, community activism. And we're going to look at some capstone projects and the ways in which artists are learning how to embody theopoetics in their work and how this is done in the classroom. So, first, the Theopoetic Conference. The Theopoetic Conference is hosted every year by Arts, Religion, and Culture, which, for those of you who have been a little mixed up, is the same organization that was one of the major three circles. So, Society of Arts, Religion, and Contemporary Culture. This is a nickname because nobody wants to say the Society for Arts, Religion, and Contemporary Culture. It's just a lot of the time. So this conference gathers scholars and religious leaders and artists and community activists. More than one, that should be S there. Not just one community activist, that would be weird. To offer wisdom to the rest of the community. The big thing about the conference is there are no keynote speakers. There's never been a keynote speaker at the Theopoetics Conference. Everyone is a who's who. In fact, if you register for the conference, part of your registration means that you get to submit your headshot and your bio. So when people click on who's going to be at the conference, it's actually every person that registered for the conference. So for people who are looking like, oh, I'm going to go see this person speak, or I'm going to go see that person speak, everybody who is coming to this conference is a person that can possibly contribute to this conference. And so everybody is the who's who. We honor artists with the artists in residency, so we try to, depending on which city that we are in, choose an artist in residency or a group that is in that community. They get a financial stipend and free registration for the conference, and they also get, they start the evening. So our opening night, it is their performance and their offering, followed by a time to ask them questions about the work that they're doing in their community, and then they're there throughout the conference to make art, to engage with the rest of the conference. And the Ruben Alves Award. The Ruben Alves Award is given to a scholar or an artist or an activist who is doing the work in the vein of Ruben Alves, who is a Brazilian theologian and one of the fathers of Theopoetics. That is nomination-based, and the person who receives that award receives a stipend. They're flown in from wherever they are. Free registration. They also are able to give a performance of their choosing and to have Q&A so they can talk more about their thing. And this is a place where those at the intersections can feel seen. We've had several people that come to our conferences. Our conferences always end with small group sessions about reflecting on how the conference went and also how the conference can be made better. And several of the people who come to those concluding sessions will always say, this is a place where I feel seen. I think I talked about this a couple days ago. There was one woman who was a pastor, an artist, and a community activist, and always said that when she entered her church context, she had to leave her artist self at the door. And then when she entered her art context, she had to leave her pastoral self at the door. And so it was just a sense that this was one of the only spaces that she had found where she could bring her whole self to. And she had just gone to church that morning, because it's Sunday, late morning. She had just gone to church that morning and felt the dissonance, and then came immediately to the closing session. It was like, this is the one place I can be my whole self. The other thing about the Theopoetics Conference is when you submit for a session, you don't have to make a claim. I remember when my first time I went to the conference and I wanted to kind of get into whether or not Octavia Butler was a Theopoet, but I actually didn't know because I was new. And the director of the conference said, well, you don't have to have an answer. You can literally, your session can literally just be the question. Like my session is Octavia Butler a Theopoet? And basically the people in the room help you answer the question. And that was my session. It was just, hey, I have a session, I have an hour. I got funding to come here to ask you if you think Octavia Butler is a Theopoid. And we just sat in the room and said, well, what about this? And, oh, what do I think about that? And it was just kind of like a space where you can just come and ask questions. Which, as an academic going to a conference, I don't know if there's a place where you can ever do that. There's also a place that has spaces for you to create art, spaces for you to connect and collaborate. There are workshops of creating embodied practices together for, so kind of like what we did for climate change. These practices are embodied with an artistic element. A workshop where different people from different communities can come and work on that together and then walk away with both connections and also some kind of tangible next step for their project when they went back to their communities. So the reason I wanted to bring this up first is because this is the hub space where most of the people in Theopoetics find each other. So most of the people who didn't know anything about Theopoetics or who didn't know anything about the scholarship or the history of it will go or will be invited to this conference. And they will come and they will go, wow, this feels kind of like home. And then that's how they'll start to get into it. So this is a huge kind of central event. We were supposed to have it in Chicago in 2020, but then 2020, and we had to cancel. And so hopefully we'll be having it some point in the next few years, in the next year or so. That's kind of up in the air. But if we do, we will probably be at United Twin Cities. So keep it posted there. The next project is the Subversive Liturgy Project. So the Friday of my first week in my doctoral program, that early morning, J.R. Thomas and his family called the Pasadena police because he, dealing with mental illness, was having an episode and needed assistance. They sent, five or so officers to his home, and through tasing and beating him, they killed him. That evening resulted in a citywide protest, that led from the place where he had passed, which at one point where I lived was literally at the end of the block. His apartment building was at the end of the block of where I moved to shortly after this happened, to and through City Hall and back. And after the protest and all of that happened, there are a couple of seminary students. They're really trying to figure out what to do, and they decided that it was important to bring the grief of the community, right? The Northwest community of Pasadena. And as you know, all cities are separated by some kind of freeway or bridge or something socioeconomically and racially. And so in Pasadena, it is the 210 freeway. So north of the 210 freeway is where a lot of the black and brown communities are. And so these seminary students said, what would it look like if we brought the grief of the community to the steps of power? And so they decided that they would make a memorial on the steps of the public entrance of the Pasadena Police Station. And so we made this memorial. It was a picture of JR. He's the father of six children. It's a picture of him holding one of his youngest child. His name and a little bio and some candles and some flowers and some incense. And at the beginning, we set it up twice a day. We set it up twice a day because the people, the employees, kept taking it down. And so eventually we got a sign-up sheet and a bunch of supplies, and with the help from the Episcopal Church across the street, we started having people sign up to just set it up every day. And because we knew at the end of the day, it would be thrown in the trash. And so we would go back and set it up, and then it would get thrown in the trash, and so on and so forth. For some reason, on Thursdays, people would gather around for a moment of silence. And that moment of silence turned to prayer. And during that time of the prayer, one of the seminary students said, what would it look like if we celebrated Advent here? What would it mean to wait in this space? And so we all got together, we wrote liturgies, and we decided to do what we called a subversive liturgy for Advent. We thought like a few of our friends would show up. That first Thursday, 60 people showed up. Now just imagine 60 people standing outside of a police station. It's a little, what's going on there? We did the first service, second service, they came back and they brought their friends. And so at the end of that last service, we decided to, this is really creepy. So at the end of the last service, we decided to ask the question, what would it look like if we did this for a year, following the liturgical calendar? And so we all, a group of us committed to come in to keeping up the daily memorial, and then coming to a Thursday service for a year. I had the honor of serving as the head liturgist for that service, for that year, and leading a team of liturgists and following the liturgical calendar. Those poems that I read to you were two of the poems that were originally written for this space. And so throughout the year, we engaged poetry, song. We invited different pastors and people from the different churches and the local churches in the community and other liturgists who were around, and we gave them free rein. All we needed to know is that the liturgy had to be centered on the prayers of the people, focused, it had to have a moment of silence for JR and an acknowledgement of the story of what happened, and that it had to end with a song that Paul's going to help me sing later, in a second, not right now. And so, in this service was an infusion of not just original poetry, some songs, I would have to find them, but also art. So there was a point where we started creating this chalk work around the front of the Pasadena police station, and they would throw water on it and wash it off. And the only time the police came out to talk to us was to let us know that they were keeping track of the amount of damages to the chalk, because at a certain monetary value, it becomes a crime. And what was really interesting in that is the pastor of the Episcopal Church, it's a really large Episcopal Church, who was white male, and had done incredible work. He'd just come from Ferguson, and he had been on the streets with the people there. When they went back in, he takes the chalk from one of the people who were there and goes and sits on the ground and starts drawing. Because he says, if they're going to arrest anyone, please arrest me. And so it was just this beautiful moment of allyship, of importance, of engaging the art, of embodiment. And so that's what we did for a year. We showed up for, you can't really tell what this is, but this is the actual, the seal on the ground of the Pasadena Police Station. And it says, we are here to protect and serve and something or whatever, whatever. And so that's kind of where we stood. So if you're here to protect and serve, then, we invite you to come out and pray with us. And they never did. And so flowers and candles and artwork and different things we did there with the help of that church. And the thing that's so interesting is I've always had a little bit of, I can't explain it, just ickiness around the project, because ultimately in what we sought out to do, we failed. We sought out to make some actual changes, to get some justice, some tangible justice for JR. But during the course of that year, we actually ended up having another memorial for another young guy who lived in the same building who was killed by an off-duty officer in a nearby city. But we always had the question of who is being subverted by this liturgy. And we quickly realized at the end of it that we were. We were being subverted because we were having to make decisions to put our bodies on the line. And we had to keep coming back to it. Two of the things that that changed in that service, one is we were able to rally several people in that community to begin to volunteer for the youth in Northwest Pasadena, in the community that JR lived, because part of our commitment was, if we're going to be committed to honoring JR in death, then we need to be committed to honoring these young people in life. So how do we volunteer? How do we donate? How do we do that? So that was one. Two, one of the young men who was in this session, he was a part of our team, he was a regular attendee, had never done anything like this before and was always kind of in this space where he never knew how to enter into the conversation of justice. And when this happened in this community, normally he wouldn't have anywhere to go to process his feelings. And he started coming to these liturgies. And he went from, I have no clue what to do, I feel paralyzed, to volunteering, to to going off on a gap year to do more volunteering, and to that shaping his whole trajectory in his ministry. There was another couple who was an older couple from the nearby church. And what I didn't know is that they were both incredible artists. One was a constructionist and a sculptor, and his wife was a painter. And she hadn't painted in, I don't know, 30 years? But she used to do portraits. And coming to these liturgies for the year reinvigorated that need to paint for her. And so she was able to actually paint portraits of several of the people on our team, including myself. And if you go to their house, their artwork is like literally everywhere. It's incredible. And so for her to create an avenue to open back up into the arts through this is an example of the awards. I also, I had a poem. Forgot about that part, I just don't. Service, liturgy, and protest, liturgical services, incorporated original liturgical components. I would like Paul to come and lead us through one of the songs that we sang. This is our benediction for every liturgy. And is anybody familiar with "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around"? The spiritual, so we're gonna practice together. I'm gonna turn this off. So person on the recording, just go look it up and or sing it silently to yourself.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me round. Keep on walking, keep on talking, walking on the freedom land. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on the freedom land.
That's how we ended every service, because in the midst of everything that was going on, not just in this space, but also in the lives of the people who had encountered this space, we had to declare every week that we weren't going to let anyone turn us around. And so this became just a really incredible transformative space for me. It actually led me to change the course of my dissertation.
Is your mic still on?
It is not. And so this is what we did every week. It actually, I'm repeating it for recording, but it actually led me to change the trajectory of my dissertation, which led me to Octavia Butler. So I was really grateful for being able to work out those elements in this space. I cannot talk about the poetics without talking about the George Floyd Memorial, but I will caveat this and say the George Floyd Memorial does not posture itself as a theopoetic. It's not saying it's a theopoetic, but I think there are a lot of resonances there. Several of you know what happened last spring with George Floyd and the reaction that it ensued, not just in this community, but worldwide. Good friend of mine, Janelle Austin, was actually born and raised two doors down from where George Floyd was killed, and was living in Austin, Texas at the time, and her family called and said to come home and to help. And so she went home, and backstory to that, when she was working at Fuller, she and the director of Fuller Chapel created a Black Lives Matter memorial on the steps in front of the main arches of the school. And they bought the pictures, laminated the pictures, set out candles, cleaned the memorial every time it got dirty, and using their administrative roles, defended the memorial for the year that it was there. Because several people were like, why do we have this? Why can't we have a picture of, I don't know, Martin Luther King or something? Why do we have to have these people on these steps? It looks bad. It's drawing too much attention. And so they defended it. And from that kind of rhythm and devotion, when she got back to her community, she went right back into that devotional work. She began to go to the memorial in the morning and begin to clean up and to tidy the memorial as a devotional practice and commitment to the community. And soon other people started to notice. So they started offering to help. And so soon she had a small team of people that were caring for the memorial. And during that process, one of those people says, wait, there's a certain way we have to do this. Because they had a background in preservation. And so they began to think about what does it mean to preserve the offerings of the community for George Floyd. And so by preserving flowers and signs and all of the artwork, they began to on this huge project of preservation, which led to a nonprofit called the George Floyd Memorial. From that came all kind of other work. They shut down that intersection. Nobody in or out. They defended that intersection and they began to work internally as a community to build and to think through what were the next steps. And so she probably wouldn't say that it's a theopoetic. She is a poet, an actual spoken word artist, and a pretty incredible one. But I think that the work that she is doing and the work that they are doing has been just so resonant with what we talked about aspects of embodied poetic sensibilities that are deeply theological, not just her theological training, but other pastors and religious leaders in that space, and is also on the path to liberation. And so it's, what's really interesting is, as they're thinking about and talking about preservation, like if somebody steps on a sign or somebody, they don't clean that up. It's all a part of preserving the moment and the offering. And one of the things that they say is when something comes into that space, everything is an offering. Everything is somebody's offering. And so they hold it with a certain level of reverence. So it can be a kid's drawing. It can be dead flowers. It can be a sign that's torn and dirty. Everything is an offering to the memory of George Floyd, but to the constant push and strive for communal liberation. And so I did not want to do a case study on theopoetics and not talk about this space. So I'm going to invite Maria Fee to come and to talk, because I think that the work that she is doing in the classroom resonates so deeply with theopoetics, and it answers your question, Cynthia, about how do you incorporate this into the classroom. And while we're also here, I highly recommend that you come back at 4 o'clock to hear about even more socially engaged art that Maria is going to be talking about, because it deeply, deeply resonates. So I'm going to put this on mute, and then we're going to switch.
And the next slide.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I've got to my PhD program, and So I got into my PhD program, and because I have an MFA in painting, I had the real fortune of. I had the fortune of being thrown into the classroom right away, and got to teach what they call a capstone class. So basically, at that point, Fuller had classes for students who had an emphasis in theology and art or art and worship, and they had to do a thesis project. And so I became the advisor for that. And so so one of the things that I first did was my pedagogy was a pedagogy of presence. So whenever we talked about socially engaged art or how art is social, they actually came to my apartment and we had a meal together. To show how rituals, like meal, actually create unity and cohesion. So it's not a theory, but an actual practice. And that practice was practiced within the classroom as pedagogy. And so that's one of the first things that I did. So if you can click. So going back to theopoetics, four methods, what's the first one?
Social location.
Social location. So, okay, social location, radical inquiry.
Asking the God question.
Asking the God question, and then the artistic response. All of those were working within their project. So because I had a, so what I did, and this is before Tanisha came up with this method, I was doing it intuitively. I had an MFA degree, so I basically applied what I learned in my graduate school program projects and applied it to this program. And so basically what I call, my students had to undergo what I call a double reflective mode. So when they were doing analysis and an inquiry and exploration from their theological education and from through an art making process or discipline. Okay, so they were doing it from both arenas. So I would ask them to tackle a problem, a gap, a perceived gap that perhaps Christianity did not answer to that they wanted to explore. A lot of them actually came with them already. This class was a trajectory for them to actually get their hands dirty and to finally incorporate their experiences through an art project and utilizing their education. So they were to explore this topic or subject, both, again, through a theological lens and through an art discipline. Now, what that means is, so that's radical inquiry. So they had to, part of that radical inquiry is, what is their social standpoint, right? Just like, how many seminarians are here? Went through seminary? Pastors. How many pastors? So, you know, even biblical hermeneutic, biblical exegesis, he's like, you know, who is Paul writing to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, same stuff that you learn in seminary. You know, what is the audience? What is the social location? Who do you want to be speaking to with your art project or exploration? What is the historical context? All those things apply to any art that you make or create. And so, for a lot of my students, they were like, well, art is self-expression. And I'm like, no. I mean, yes.
Like, no.
Yeah.
So, and part of when you adopt an art discipline, that means that it's not just concept, like, here's the concept. The concept is the things that are driving your exploration, right? But the form. And so they had to do research projects trying to figure out what the inspirations for their forms and their concepts were. So in all, basically, this capstone project fortified their theological exploration and made it, incarnated it, mm-hmm. put flesh on it. Mm-hmm. And from the art point of view, it deepened the art project because it had all this weight to it. Mm-hmm. So let me, let me talk about a couple of them. Up here we see Mercy McVeigh Young. She was a gardener, a seminarian, and she came into my class and was like, how is making a garden artwork? And that's what she did. She created a garden in a nearby property at Fuller, and so there was an aesthetic, creative process of making the garden, but then the garden became the place to teach gardening methods and sustainability, so how to compost, that's what that compost bucket is. But it also became a place to deal, to have ethical conversations on land and ecology, and so that's our ethics professor there, Hongjuk Lee. And so from this one project, it had three prongs. Oh, and it also became a place to do, you know, biblical hermeneutics and re-seeing certain biblical texts from the point of getting your hands dirty. So you got your hands dirty. Now you have a different perspective on reading the text. And then on top of that, you had an ethical lens as well. And so all of that was combined within her theology, her capstone project. So she's, you can see all the multiple discourses that, again, with theopoetics, is you're inviting different contexts, different discourses into creating these art projects. The Braids was a student, a Korean student who lived in Japan, who was doing her studies in the U.S. and California, right? So she picked up the motif of the braid because she's trying to make sense of her own alienation. You know, being Korean and then Japanese, you know, culture, but then also being in American culture, and also it's issues of immigration and identity, and so the braid became a way for her to explore her tri-part identity, but also theological tri-Trinitarian concepts. But the braid became a way of also creating workshops for multiple age levels on how to talk about difference and diversity. And so participants created the braids with questions. So each person had a strand, and they had to do this little dance of interweaving these strands and the strands, and the strands came with questions. And, you know, so she worked these workshops from ages 4 to adults in secular and in Christian communities. And so the braids were all collected and became part of an installation in multiple places. So here you see it in my church at Hollywood Press, and this is at a gallery in Florida, I think, at a university also. So she showed the installation in various locations across the country. Ouch.
Yeah, it does that sometimes.
There are so many different kinds of capstone projects. I had films that were entered into film competition, film, you know, festivals. I had books published from it. This Illume, yes. So one student was a theater poet, and she, do you guys know what playback theater is? Or, okay, so there's a form of theater where you're not going according to a play text, it's devised. So if you tell your story, then the actors have to devise these shapes. And so she, Brianna, created a Loom playback theater, and she took that playback and put it in the context of community and worship and created a whole vocabulary so that people could worship and be heard and seen through playback theater. One of the most startling and heartfelt iterations was she did this at the SIVA conference, Christians in the Visual Arts. It was at the end, and it was a liturgy, it was a Sunday worship, and at the end, she would do prayers according to this. So she would say, what is your, you know, she would ask the congregants, what is your prayer request? And at that point, I don't remember which Black life got murder happened at that point, I can't remember. But one person, can we pray for the mothers of those who, of the sons and daughters who've been murdered? And Brianna just sobbed for about 5 minutes, like wailing. And we all had to enter into that lament. She allowed her body to become the conduit of that narrative and story. Mm-hmm. And so so these are the incredible works that seminarians are doing from theopoetic, and that they're investigating these things that for a lot of them, they had these questions and there was no place for them to ask them. Mm-hmm. As you were talking about the conference, and the class became a way for them to direct those inquiries. Now we would have at the end of the year, we would have what we call art ventures, which is kind of where they got to present their projects, and it was kind of like a TED Talk. They all had 15 minutes. They had to all bring their things, and those were really powerful evenings. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
What's important about that is, like she said several times during her presentation, this was all before. Oh yeah, huh? I guess I have to. You're just trying to get rid of it. It's fine. This was all before I decided to write a method. This is probably all before I really started my dissertating and exams and doctoral program. So theopoetics is not claiming that this thing is a new thing. This is intuitive in people who are living in these spaces. So this is intuitive for Maria because she already lies at the intersection of embodied, spiritual, artistic sensibilities that she infuses not just into the ways that she knows, but into her pedagogy, in the way she teaches others to realize how they already know. Theopoetics just becomes a way that we can articulate that. Mm-hmm. Theopoetics becomes a resonating term or name to help us identify that. It could also be similar to where, you know, the altars are built or things are built. It's like, okay, what will we name this? Who is God in this context, right? And then we offer a name, and that name helps us to understand what has happened here. I think in many ways, Theopoetics isn't trying to create anything new. Theopoetics at its best is an articulation of what is happening here. And I think this is an excellent space, because it's not only her knowing, but it's her helping others to know what they already are embodying.
Yeah.
And I think that is the importance of Theopoetics. We'll have a couple of questions, and we will still, I'm not gonna like desert you after I get ice cream, just so you know.
Dessert
us. We are, I'm too funny for my own good, it's okay. But I do wanna answer a couple of questions. And then, Maria, where you, I don't know where you're going.
I'm right behind you.
Okay, great. So a couple of questions, and then we're going to field trip. And then, person on the recording, if you're listening to this, you can go ahead and get ice cream. I highly recommend coffee ice cream, salted caramel ice cream, or if you're lactose intolerant, a sorbet would be rather delicious. Okay, questions.
Do you see examples of this in rural areas? I mean, most of this is urban, and I know it would be great, but I can't imagine anything that I've heard of.
So not from a Christian point of view. Later on in the afternoon, I'm going to show a social practice artist. I'm not going to show this one example, but there's one example that I do write about where this dramatist went back to her rural community in Virginia, trying to explore this male persona and demystify it. And so she actually puts on a play in the parking lots of, you know, the gas stations and the Quickie Mart. And so part of the play also has, you know, talk back on what does it mean to be a male from Virginia? What it means to be blue state, red state? What does it mean? And so these questions are brought up through the performance. The performance makes a way for these discussions, weighty discussions, to happen. So there are artists working in rural areas in this kind of theopoetic light. Again, not from a Christian point of view, but trying to bring together parties that are usually kept apart.
And I can add that what you see here is, in many ways, can be translatable. Invoking a garden, right, that talks about not only composting, but the effects of what we learned this morning about climate change and the environment can be done in many different areas. The dancing and the movement is just a matter of space and imagination, right? So a lot of these different things and even materials can be translated into non-urban environments. Cynthia had a question, and then I'm going to come to Laura. Unless, Laura, your question was directly resulted.
It is directly related to that.
Okay,
I was just going to challenge that I serve a United Methodist church and a Lutheran church. My Lutheran ladies, every Wednesday, make quilts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I would challenge that's theopoetics.
Totally, yeah.
And so I think even in rural situations, you can find avenues of ways that people live their art and their faith simultaneously.
Amen.
Together.
Yes. Because what's the first step? It's the social location.
Right.
What are we already doing that God is already at work in?
Yes.
And then pulling out more out of that.
You know? I don't know if they would necessarily articulate it that way.
No.
But I sure do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. No, I think that's a good point. We're going to go to Cynthia, and then we're going to go to, remind me of your name?
Holly.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, my question is sort of a twofold question, because Maria, you said that they ask a question and then explore it through a twofold discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And one is through a regular theological discourse, and the other is through artistic expression. And my first question is, could you give us a couple of examples of the questions that some
Sure.
students ask? And then my second question is, you know, trained in binary thinking here. When you said a double form of expression, or a double reflective mode, I of course thought, oh, they do a theological discourse paper and they do an artistic expression. But you were not saying that. You were saying that they were molded together.
Sure. Of course, I have there are strategies and a framework. They have to, the first quarter, we go by quarter system. The first quarter is their she wants the technical, the logistics. So the first quarter, we're going over examples of what I mean, you know, and they have to, at the end of the term, hand in a proposal. Now, the proposal is great because it's twofold. They get to do writing, but if they want to take, so I also see this as a calling card. When they leave seminary, they actually have something concrete. Mm-hmm. So they better have that proposal, because then they're ready to propose it to whatever organization or community they're going to be working in. So that's number one. So the proposals are ready. The proposal is the artist statement, the mission statement, the logistics, what is the inquiry, you know, all that is all in that paper. And that's, if they so choose, they even use that for their TED Talk, if they so choose. Mm-hmm. So many times students start one place and they end up, mm-hmm. after the exploration, in another place, and that's beautiful. I have to also say, when you saw the dinner picture, because we're working as a cohort, and part of it is teaching them, critiquing one another from a place of camaraderie, and not like in the art world, critique is like killer, you know. It's going to get you down. But doing an alternative way of critique, which is for the betterment of the project and of the student, I got to see that. Mm-hmm. And because they were all critiquing one another, they all had buy-in to one another's. They all helped each other's projects. Mm-hmm. The film people is three students working on the film. Mm-hmm. Almost every student in that capstone cohort was in the film or did something part of that film project. So you have a spirit of collaboration. All this is all of an aside to the project itself. So we have, in a sense, a model of what Christian community looks like in reality when we're all working together. Mm-hmm. So it's a beautiful model. Now, I forgot the question that, yes. So what was your second?
A sample.
Okay, so at the head of the table is Melody, and she was actually a SIS student, meaning she was into intercultural studies, but she loved to make art. And yet she was very worried about alienation and fragmentation. So she created, so her question was, how do we use the arts, and how do the arts kind of mediate and bring cohesion to all these things? And so she created these maps. She actually used maps and then began to physically explore that so that she can begin to understand all the complexities of what that meant for her. She's now went to St. Andrews and she's now studying her PhD. Another was Megan, who wanted to understand, she's a musician, and how as a woman and as a musician do we talk about depression and femininity from a Christian point of view through hymnology? And so she created her own music, but also she took some hymns and rephrased it from a feminine perspective. Danielle's a writer, and she was thinking she'd write a booklet of kind of like a devotional. Well, her husband had
terminal cancer,
stage 4 cancer. And so she wrote an autobiography that was devotional, and that kind of helped us, and it was all part of seeing God or looking for God from that perspective of being by a hospital bed. Now, when she read it, some of her excerpts, she actually, you were part of that.
Me and Claire.
Yeah. The three women were the voices of that devotional, and they were set up like Rublev's icon. You ever see the Rublev icon? If you know the three strangers that come to meet Abraham are also the Trinity. And so she had set it up visually, so these three readers were the three angels, the three persons of the Trinity, mm-hmm. set up just like the icon. So Tamisha was one of the readers for that project.
I played God.
Yeah.
And then she was herself.
Yeah.
And then Claire was Jesus.
Another, Jeremy is into noise rock and the kind of community that is based and follows that around. And so he created his own album, LP, that later was produced, but also he went on to PhD studies on that genre and that idea of camaraderie through music. So mm-hmm. those are just a bit. I mean, I can go on and on. You don't want to hear me too.
So much. Thank you for that.
Can I say something real quick? I just want to, since I'm outside, you can see the gardening issue, when you brought that up, and she's like, how can that be an art form? And I just want to throw out that, from the art historian point of view, that was considered to be a major art discipline in many times of human history, especially medieval times, you know, where it wasn't like that needed to be defended as an art form, but it was automatically assumed to be one. It's also in Eastern cultures.
Huh? And earthworks from the 70s. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess my question is similar. I just retired from the Snohomish Conservation District, and so we're doing a lot of rural work with farmers and asking a lot of sustainability questions and working with the farmers. So how does that grow from those questions and that action to the theological piece of the equation, of the theopoetics?
How does she grow it, or how does it grow just generally?
How does it, like the vision of this theopoetics?
So what are some of the questions?
So you're doing this action.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you are kind of going deeper into the questions, but then you need to start asking it from a biblical God idea perspective?
It depends on the student. I'm sorry. I wish I can give you a... But yes. It could be that. It could be the work of one specific theologian. It could be the work of someone who's doing it in the secular realm, and then the student's giving it a theological perspective or view of that. Like this afternoon, none of the artists that I'm going to be showing are, that I know of, Christian, but I'm taking it as a theologian from a theological position and naming what I think it is. So that could be one method. One method is work and worship, cultus. Those things go hand in hand. Why shouldn't we be talking about the earth and how we utilize it without talking about worship?
You also think about the cultivation of growth and the processes that's infused in a project like this. And you'll see in the Way to Water book that a lot of the imagery that Khaled uses when he talks about theopoetics is steeped in nature, right? This is the same with Adrian Marie Brown in Emergent Strategies, right? It's the biomimicry, the ways in which we look to the earth and to the creatures of the earth to learn from. And so I think that there is a lot there. It's also to say, I'm really glad that she said, you know, it depends on the student, because it can be highly contextual, right? That's why social location is important. So the first question is who is the community that is looking to do this work, and what is their question? What is the question that is, you know, at the forefront of that community in that time? And what step are they at in their learning about their own embodied creative sensibilities that they're developing? Everybody is at different stages in that process. And so there may be different needs, right, that the same practice can address, but it really does start with the question, that social location, and that willingness to move into and allow, in this case, the earth to speak.
Yeah, and that's why the cohort model is great, because the students are asking this question, and they're all part of that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I could just see some people in their work burning out, you know, trying to keep engaged in a difficult process or a long process, and if you could take that step, how much hope and just grow, you know, just like this is good work, and this, it's a grounding work, and if you don't get there, you can just, just start modeling, right?
It's true, but it's not a Malone work, right?
Yeah.
It is a deeply communal work. And even as you are entering into a space that you are creating something, like when we talk about imaginations, I say all the time, imaginations are tethered, right? Mm-hmm. So they're tethered to the things that inspire us. And so even if I am alone in my room writing a poem or what have you, I am not alone in my room because there is a community that I am writing to, right? There is a space that has inspired me that I am writing from. And in that, I am not alone.
And then that poem does get workshopped. So
it does.
Also getting the critique of the community in love this time, not like in a normal poetry workshop.
Right.
You know, and so, hey, did you think about that? And so also what is interesting is when you're working in a community, your ideas and what people are doing ignite solutions or, this one's doing that. I could do that, but in this thing.
Right.
And so, and I heard one student said, it's like, oh my gosh, when I heard that person's doing that, I needed to be really accountable and I really need to take serious my project. Mm. And so there's also an accountability into the cohort model that comes.
We have a couple more questions and then ice cream. Yes.
Well, I was just thinking, I mean, it seems like there are so many ways you could go with this,
mm-hmm.
both in classrooms and in churches. And I was thinking about, and this would apply to a church or a classroom, taking a concept or a paradox or a contradiction and having that you want students or parishioners to deeply explore. And normally in a classroom, you explore it through intellectual activity. And sometimes, more emotional self-reflection. But what if you took a concept like moral power and despair, as two polar opposites, or took a concept like climate colonialism and mm-hmm. decolonizing, and then said, now the assignment is to explore that through artistic expression. So it might give, or even to have a small group, explore a paradox or a word or a term that you want them to dig more deeply into and do it through some form of artistic expression. Can you give any thoughts about how to do something like that more creatively?
Okay, so working with people who tend to be non-artists.
Yeah.
Mm. And yes. To make them be artists is really, it's hard because all you all are going to say, what? You want me to do what? And so people freak out. So you do have, I find that the more guidelines you have or specifics eases that. I think maybe you and I could just talk about that later So one way, I make my, for social, again, this is this
don't
afternoon.
Take all your stuff for
four. Yeah, I'll save it for this afternoon. So social, I make my students, I show them all these, what I'm going to show later,
mm-hmm.
as an examples.
Mm-hmm.
And so that ignites the imagination, and that also gives them a vocabulary, a wider mm-hmm. vocabulary of how to
mm-hmm.
do it. So, and that helps.
I try to do different things that are, mm-hmm. that kind of rear out their thinking too. Mm-hmm. So for mm-hmm. my writing and telling your cultural story course,
mm-hmm.
there's one movement exercise that we do that's taken kind of from
mm-hmm.
the theater game statues,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I give them an emotion mm-hmm. and I tell them to strike a pose. You don't think about it, you just do it, and you trust that your body knows how you embody that emotion. And so then I begin to call out all of these different emotions, and I go back to the other one so they can remember, and it gives them a chance to kind of think about how your body holds emotion,
mm-hmm.
and then they form a statue, and then we get to walk around them like in 3D and make observations about what they're doing, and then somebody assumes that position and they get to step out of themselves and to see how their body has embodied that emotion and see it on someone else and begin to make observations. And so for them, they go, I didn't think that I would think about my best self that way. Why is my hand like this? Why am I doing this? And then they go and they tell a story about that.
The reflection part.
And then it's the reflection part. And they tell a story from their actual lives. Like, what came up for you? What story about your life came up for you when you saw that, what your body did.
And the art becomes the impetus to go deeper. That's
right.
That's the thing, is the art is the diving board. So you could even take a piece, hand each student a piece of paper, give them your two topics, and said, okay, do something with this paper that will show the essence of these two topics.
Mm-hmm. You know, for non-artists, maybe you could also, you made me think of something else, you could ask them to use art that's been created.
Definitely.
By someone else.
Yes, you can.
And dig into that.
That's one of the first things as a, for my first, I teach an online class, and so for students to know one another on an online class, you know, anybody teach online? So I make them do, introduce themselves by offering a work of art that they feel strongly relates to who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, and so that helps engage each other, but from a deeper point of view, because the artwork itself now navigates and informs in ways that a paragraph online doesn't, you know.
And sometimes for... Yeah. When I write on my blog, it's been a while, I'll have a section at the bottom called Mood, and it just has all of the things that has inspired that thought. So TV shows, songs, art pieces, gallery showings, and also when I guest lecture, I'll create a playlist for the students to engage that lives into kind of like what it, all of the themes that we are talking about. And so they get to go on to Spotify, Apple Music, or whatever, and listen to the play. Now they have a different mode, right? So now when they encounter that super popular song again or something, it constantly invokes in new ways. And it also encourages them to think about how they can engage in these conversations outside of, let me go sit in a class, read a book, and take notes. It expands that the possibilities for engagement are wider than what we traditionally give in the classroom. So then they can go, this reminds me of this one song I heard that da, 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 da. And that's acceptable because all of that stuff is living in there, right? And it also expands them to think that art is not simply for our entertainment and consumption.
Yeah, that it's communication.
There can be more.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, everybody has a cell phone with a camera in it. Ta-da, instant art. So I make my students do a self-portrait as a part of and so the self-portrait is the hand. Mm-hmm. The way the hand's placed, where is it, what's the lighting, what are the incidentals around it, and then they have to, you know, they send their files to me, and that's how they introduce themselves to each other. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funky how, like, months later, you look at those hand portraits, and they really do fit and epitomize that student. You know, it's just really incredible, so... Mm-hmm.
I've been having students introduce themselves by, if they were a plant, what plant would they be? And then they describe it and say why, and then they do something physical
beautiful
to manifest that plant.
That's beautiful. Same.
And it gets it into their bodies. I have a friend, and we're gonna head over to ice cream. And you can ask questions more than just about this. You can ask questions just about the aquatics. But whenever she facilitates groups after they hear something, she does this thing where she has them stand and to think about what they heard, right? What resonated with them. And anything that resonated with them, if they can feel that in a certain part of their body, she asks them to rub it in. And then she goes, if you can feel it, just rub it in. Just rub that. You want to hold that in your body. And anything that doesn't resonate with them or they want to get away, she has them, you know, and everybody's going around going like this and they're doing all these things. But it reminds them that their bodies are a part of the experience that they're having, right? It's not just up here, right? Your whole body is engaged. You lean forward when it's something like that. You lean back if you're like, like you make facial expressions. You do all of these things with your bodies. But when it comes to learning, sometimes we forget about that. And so little notions to remind people that, you know, the embodiment of learning is present whether you acknowledge it and utilize it or not, is another entryway to get people to kind of open up into the space that could possibly lead to something like
that. And I've seen that work. Yeah.
Yeah. So that being said, we're gonna use our bodies. We're gonna walk. Then we're gonna use our cards or our wallets. We're gonna buy some ice cream. Or you can just sit down and hang and we'll continue the conversation. Questions are open. So if there's something from the last couple of sessions are just in general that you have a question about, we have time. If you would rather rest and just leave,
I will not be offended. Tomorrow. I'm so excited. So tomorrow we're going to be talking about Theopoetics and Octavia Butler, which is my dissertation topic. So I can talk a lot, and I'm going to try not to talk a lot because I want to hear from you. But I will be reading some sections of her work, and we will be talking about why Earthseed is a theopoetic. So
is what?
A theopoetic. Oh. Mm-hmm. So that'll be the last day, and that is all for today. Until we get back.
Thank you.